Welcome to today's SNEB webinar, sponsored by the St. Louis District Dairy Council. Glad to have you with us today. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB. And to start with, if you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, you should see four different handouts available today. Three of those are actually some reference material for you, but if you look for the one that says presentation, those are the slides for today. And so if you would like to download those and follow along, that might be helpful during our presentation. We will take questions at the end of the webinar, so please type those in the question block. We have a large attendance today, so if for some reason we do not get to all the questions, we will definitely do a follow-up email and answer any questions we weren't able to address live. When I close out the webinar today, you'll see a short survey. And we greatly appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future sessions. This is actually the fifth webinar that the St. Louis District Dairy Council has sponsored with SNEB, so ideas for future sessions are much appreciated. And then watch for a follow-up email. I'll have that out by the end of the day on Friday. The follow-up will include the link to the recording that we're making, the handout slide material again, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance. So our moderator today is Monica Nyman. She's a nutrition educator with the St. Louis District Dairy Council. She earned her master's degree in family and consumer sciences from Illinois State University and is a registered and licensed dietitian. Her background includes experience in diabetes education and program management, surgical and non-surgical weight loss counseling, and also community education.
Thank you, Rachel. Good morning, everyone. As she said, my name is Monica Nyman, and I am a dietitian with the St. Louis Dairy Council. And our organization is a nonprofit nutrition education organization whose mission is to communicate the role and necessity of dairy foods as part of a healthful diet. Since 1932, the Dairy Council has worked with key leaders in education, with health professionals, consumer groups, and the media. And our organization is funded by local dairy producers through the federal checkoff program. We're headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri, and the Dairy Council also has satellite offices located in Bloomington, Illinois, as well as Springfield, Illinois, and we serve a 131-county area. Our staff is comprised of professionals with experience in education, food service management, nutrition, and communications. And we are really excited that you're joining us today and giving us the opportunity to provide dairy nutrition-focused continuing education to health professionals from Illinois, Missouri, and around the country. We're also delighted to have with us Jamie Capizzi as our speaker. Jamie is a registered and licensed dietitian in the St. Louis area. She completed the coordinated program in medical dietetics at the University of Missouri, Columbia. She's also a certified lactation counselor. Jamie has a unique professional background, including a clinical dietitian for SSM, a wellness program manager at the University of Missouri, pediatric nutrition representative for Gerber Nestle, and currently territory manager and clinical sales trainer for Sigma Tau Health Science USA. Jamie is passionate about the microbiome and how products, natural and supplemented, can affect a person's health at birth and beyond. She's on the St. Louis Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Board and actively supports the CCFA. Finally, she lives in St. Louis and has three boys that keep plenty of germs in the house. So welcome, Jamie Capizzi.
Thank you, Monica, and thanks to all of you for making time today to learn about the microbiome. Hopefully you can see that slide up on your computer. The title is Probiotics, Understanding the Microbiome and the Role of Probiotics in Long-Term Health. Please feel free to reach out to me with any additional questions. I have my email and my cell phone there for you. And I have a lot of references. I think I got up to about 44 for this presentation, so I will also share that list with you. It would be on with the slides of the presentation. So the objectives for today are to learn the history of probiotics and the importance of their unique functions in a healthy diet, understand the difference between microbiota and microbiome, be able to identify sources of clinically relevant information on the microbiome, and understand probiotics supplementation options, including food sources and dietary supplements. So I do have one disclaimer that I'll let you read. And we'll first go into the history of probiotics. And if you've been through a webinar on probiotics, you have heard about Dr. Metchnikoff. He is especially important because of his landmark observation that regular consumption of lactic acid bacteria in fermented dairy products, such as yogurt, was associated with enhanced health and longevity in Bulgarian peasant populations. And he was able to link that improved health to a specific strain, Bulgarian bacillus. And he demonstrated how healthy bacteria in yogurt facilitated digestion and enhanced the immune system. So back then, when they didn't have thousands of options with probiotic supplements, he was still able to link the immune system with simply incorporating yogurt. And this always cracks me up that something that was published way back in 1907, you can still order on Amazon. So two other men that were notable in probiotic and antibiotic discoveries were Pasteur, who noticed that common bacilli could suppress anthrax growth, and Alexander Fleming. He noticed that antiseptics only killed harmful bacteria on the surface, and he discovered penicillin by accident in 1928. And with this discovery, there was a lot of distraction from Metchnikoff going into probiotics, and now a lot of research was going into antibiotics. So obviously, Alexander Fleming has saved a lot of lives with his penicillin discovery, but unfortunately, there is an overuse today that we'll get into a little bit more further in the conversation, that 40% of all adults and 70% of kids in the U.S. take at least one round of antibiotics annually. Kind of shocking. So we were on the right track linking gut health with chronic disease and fiber intake. Dr. Cleavey is the first man, was a naval physician, and he treated a lot of illnesses with bran. So he knew that there was a connection there with dietary fiber and treating illnesses. So he linked modern disease to people starting to consume a lot of refined carbohydrates and decreasing the amount of dietary fiber in their diet. And around the same time, Dr. Burkitt studied a certain African population and discovered that this African population ate 60 to 140 grams of fiber per day. They had 3 to 5 times larger stools, as you would expect, and they had twice the gut transit times. So kind of going along with Cleavey as well, that when they had that high fiber intake, everything was moving through their system and they weren't having any of these modern diseases that we deal with. And he was quoted as saying, if you pass small stools, you have to have large hospitals. So I think that's very accurate. And he also published Don't Forget Fiber in Your Diet in 1979. So to me, it seemed like we were doing pretty well in understanding gut health linked to chronic illnesses, and then squirrel. So anyone that has seen the movie Up will get that reference. But the Seven Countries study came out, and it was done by Ansel Keys, and everyone left that fiber discussion that was so important to join the low-fat diet revolution. However, we have learned recently that in this study, there were only 7 of 22 countries reported on. He ignored countries with high-fat and low cardiovascular disease and low-fat, high cardiovascular disease findings. And this distraction has lasted decades and gave us even more refined carbs. So it has taken many years to get back to the gut. Finally, in 1980, probiotics were defined as live microbial supplements, which beneficially affect the host animal by improving its microbial balance. And in 2001, the WHO defined it as, the World Health Organization defined probiotics finally as live microorganisms, which administered in adequate amounts confer a health benefit to the host. So now there's a lot of increased interest in probiotics. So just looking at last year, we had over 1,600 studies done using probiotics. And if you do just a simple PubMed search using the term probiotics, you'll get back over 15,000 hits. So there's a lot of information out there, and it's just how are we able to kind of harness it and use it clinically is where we're at today. So why are these live organisms vital to our health? Bacteria is everywhere. And it's not necessarily all bad. There are thousands of species, and each bacterial community is unique to a person's microbiome. So basically, we just need more time to get to know, you know, what bacteria is where and how are they helping us or how are they hurting us, especially with chronic disease. So this is just a depiction of what normal gut flora looks like. As we know, the stomach is the most acidic with a pH of about 1.5 to 3.5. And the oxygen gradient is highest proximally in the gut and lowest in the colon. So not a lot of bacteria in the stomach because of this, and most resides in the colon. So if you look in the box on the top right, we see that there's only about 10 to 100 CFUs, which means colony-forming units per mil. And as we get to the colon, it increases back up to about 7, and that's where we have around 10 billion to 1 trillion bacteria. So obviously the probiotics are most effective in the large intestine. So what do they do for us? They do a lot of things for us. The first is that they synthesize some vitamins that we do not have the genes to make, including some B vitamins and vitamin K. And then one of the most important ones is their production of short-chain fatty acids. And how that works is the live microorganisms eat indigestible fiber, among other things, and we'll learn about that later. It's kind of a new, exciting part of research. And a byproduct of this process is short-chain fatty acids. So this is where there's an argument for live bacteria. You know, basically, if a bacteria is dead, it's not eating, so how is it producing as many short-chain fatty acids? However, you know, I'm not saying that dead bacteria doesn't confer any health benefits. So with the short-chain fatty acids, we have butyric acid, acetate, and propionate. And they have many functions within the gut. They have a protective effect on the epithelium. They stimulate fluid absorption. They fuel cell proliferation and turnover. They play a part in Treg differentiation. And they help with anti-inflammatory signaling, which enhances neuronal maturation and intestinal motility. So that has to do with the enteric nervous system, which we will also discuss. So finally, pathogenic colonization resistance, which is huge. The probiotics stimulate IgA production, which helps produce mucus, and that provides a protective layer on top of the epithelium. They promote anti-inflammatory cytokines while down-regulating pro-inflammatory cytokines, which basically just means they help with inflammation. They engage with dendrite cells, which are the messengers for our immune system, so they help instruct the immune system on how to properly respond and not to overreact. And epithelial cell integrity. The epithelium itself is only about one cell thick, so it is one cell thick, so we need tight junctions in between each cell to be intact to avoid any autoimmune cascade. So in my picture here, a compromised space in the epithelium can allow pathogens to reach the immune system and wreak havoc, which we don't want to happen. So looking at this slide, which gate would you prefer to protect your immune system? So the gate represents our toll-like receptors. So if we let anyone in, good and bad, we are in a state of hyperpermeability or have a leaky gut. So continuing with what else they do for us, it just doesn't stop. So there is a strong microbial component to obesity, and there's a lot of studies right now going on with obesity because obviously it's a plague that we are all dealing with. But studies show germ-free mice that receive a fecal microbiome transplant from an obese mouse start to gain excessive weight. But what's interesting about this as dietitians is that in these studies, it didn't matter if the obese mouse was overfed an unhealthy diet or if it had a genetic mutation that made it obese. The feces still made the germ-free mouse gain excessive weight. So obviously this information has a lot of people wondering if fecal microbiome transplants will be a future obesity treatment. So very promising there. And they work with probiotics, work with the diet to promote bacterial diversity and help promoting metabolites. Oops, sorry, went the wrong way. So then we go on to how they affect drug metabolism. And this is almost, it is a whole new field of study called pharmacogenomics, like basically how our genes affect how well we metabolize and use drugs. So the microbiome can affect efficacy, and there are studies out there evaluating if the microbiome affects the metabolism of drugs and how that determines if certain drugs will be more effective than others. So if someone's in a state of dysbiosis and they're given a certain medication, you know, there's maybe another one that would work better with that person having the dysbiosis. So the enteric nervous system function is also a new field of study. There's so much studies going on, and a lot of it is related to the microbiome. So it's always exciting learning what comes out every day. So with the how the microbiome affects the function of the system, specifically is looking at how the microbiome affects peristalsis, transmucosal fluid flux, local blood flow, release of intestinal hormones, nutrient absorption, immune system interaction, and studies with GABA. So we may know that GABA is a neurotransmitter that plays an effect in depression and anxiety. So there's two cool studies that have come out. The first one coming out of Northwestern University, they actually documented bacteria eating GABA. So GABA was the nutrition source to make that bacteria thrive. And then on the other side, GABA is produced by intestinal bacteria, which helps with homeostasis and motility. And GABA, as I mentioned, is linked to depression and anxiety. So we have like the synergistic effect of GABA. So some bacteria are eating it while others are making it. So obviously it's important to have both species there. And so this is just a visual of what we've been discussing. So the microbial layer of protection, it's more meaning more good than bad bacteria, helps protect the lower sections. The physical barrier of the mucus and the epithelium. And then you can see the dendrites, it's orange in color, kind of towards the middle by the plasma cell. You can see a dendrite cell reaching up for a sample to bring back into the immune system to educate the system on how to react. So it's constantly learning from the bacteria that's present in our guts. So, and then the mucus layer, which I mentioned was a physical barrier. In healthy people, a bilayer mucus structure is promoted in the large intestine. The inner layer of that is thought to be sterile and attached to the epithelium to provide protection. And then the outer layer is more fluid and containing the microbes. The purpose of the mucus layer is to provide additional protection because of the following in the large intestine environment. So in the large intestine, you have a higher bacterial load, you have reduced antimicrobial peptides, and you have increased colonic transit time for the feces. So we need more protection there. And then some new studies that came out, too, that I think make dietitians even more important is that we need to continue to promote healthy eating and high fiber intake in terms of gut health, because studies now show, as the last point on the page, if we don't consume the right amount of prebiotics, bacteria will start to eat the mucus layer for nutrition. So you're letting that epithelium become vulnerable to pathogens. So disease pathogenesis is basically determined by what is going on in the gut, where about 70% of your immune system is working hard. So dysbiosis does play a part, and it basically you're evaluating, so are there more harmful bacteria than commensal or vice versa? Is there a lot of damage from chronic inflammation? Do we have a dilapidated gait like I had in the other slide for a toll-like receptor and it has allowed pathogens to enter the bloodstream and kicked off that autoimmune cascade? As I mentioned on the previous slide, there's a reduced secretion of the antimicrobial peptides. With disease, that mucus layer has become compromised, so years and years and years of not eating enough fiber. The bacteria has eaten away the mucus layer, so again, it leaves that vulnerable. Are there areas that should be less aerobic that have actually become quite oxygenated, promoting death of appropriate strains and viability for ones that shouldn't be there? So that kind of goes into a lot of like the PPIs affecting the pH of the intestine and bariatric surgery, and those are fields of study that are looking into that. And finally, the pH and how quickly things move through plays a part. And this is a great book. I have books throughout this that if you all are interested in learning more about the microbiome. These are ones that I have found are very useful. This was written by Dr. Martin Blaser. It's called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plague. So again, if, as I mentioned in the beginning, that if 40% of adults and 70% of kids are taking antibiotics annually, it's just affecting our long-term health, because as studies continue, it's showing that it's not only a year after you stop taking that probiotic, it could be indefinitely that you've hurt your microbiome. So basically, eradication of bacteria is not the answer. So our microbiome is essential to our health, so how do we take care of it? Your microbiome is your internal fingerprint. I'm sure you've seen this before on microbiome discussions. It takes into account, your fingerprint is made on based on how you were born, how were you fed, were you breastfed, were you formula fed, where did you live, did you have any pets, was your home very clean, did you take antibiotics as an infant or child, and this is kind of a newer question, did your mom eat fermented foods or take a probiotic supplement? So there's studies, and I have that reference there if you want to look it up, but looking at how, if a mom has increased her probiotic consumption and how that affects gene expression in the child. So that's a new field of study as well. So taking care of your microbiomes. If you support your microbiome, it would look like a lush rainforest. You know, you can barely see the ground. There's lots of diversity there. And then a microbiome that is diseased or not well supported may look more like this. So obviously, the ground is very vulnerable, which would represent the epithelial cells. So there's not a lot of diversity there either. So what affects your microbiome? Autoimmune disease, chronic disease, medications, as I mentioned, PPIs, NSAIDs, and metformin. You know, there's a new study just recently came out showing how metformin affects the gut in diabetics, so, and not a positive way, obviously. So medications play a huge part in this. Antibiotics, as Dr. Blaser's book researches, how the diet affects it, activity, smoking, stress level. You know, as Americans, we're under a chronic stress level, and that's not healthy for our microbiome. Air pollution, and finally, environment. So this takes us into the hygiene hypothesis. So we had all these issues with infectious diseases and barely had any autoimmune diseases. And then flip side, you look more recently, and now we have no infectious diseases, and we have all these autoimmune diseases. So like I mentioned with Dr. Blaser, you know, getting rid of all this bacteria is not necessarily the answer. So the things that take place for the hygiene hypothesis are environment and food are more sanitized. You know, we're not gardening, we're not getting our hands dirty, and you know, we have this extra clean food that we're going to the grocery store to buy. We have antibacterial soaps, alcohol-based sanitizers, less interaction with dirt, urban lifestyles, C-section delivery, which accounts for about 30% of deliveries, formula feeding versus breastfeeding, antibiotics, and not playing outside. You know, a lot of these kids are on the couch playing video games and not outside getting dirty, and that's taken a toll on everyone's health as well. And then these are my favorite things, that when they have, like, every color and scent on everything they own, which is obviously the hand sanitizer. So we move into the human microbiome and how that differs from microbiota. So the microbiome is an ecosystem. It's involving the host and the microbiota. So it's focusing on genetics. Not anymore that we know just what two strains are there, but how does each one affect the other and how is it affecting the host, which I, you know, refer to as synergy. And microbiota is the 10 to 100 trillion microbial cells living in or on the host. And that's just the basic taxonomy of it. And this is an analogy that I thought of. So with the ecosystem, you have your to-do list. And with the microbiota, you have a guest list. So they're two very different things. But the microbiome is, like I said, an ecosystem that's live and functioning. So with strain synergy, I thought this was appropriate for dietitians. So if we have an anemic patient, you know, we might recommend pairing steak with tomatoes that are high in vitamin C. Or if you have a patient with osteoporosis, you know, combining calcium and vitamin D for improved absorption. So with bacteria, it's pretty much the same way. It's important that we have multiple strains and lots of diversity. And going back to the GABA example, you know, some strains make it, some strains eat it, but obviously we need both there to maintain mental health with that neurotransmitter. So we're kind of just in the infancy of learning about which strains are necessary and which ones need to be with each other, but that's, I thought, just kind of a good analogy with how we recommend foods to patients. So current projects, the Human Microbiome Project, it was started in 2008. The purpose was to generate resources so experts can figure out how alterations in the microbiome affect health, good and bad. And this is an explanation on the website. An ever-growing number of studies have demonstrated that changes in the composition of our microbiome correlate with numerous disease states, raising the possibility that manipulation of these communities could be used to treat disease. So metagenomics is defined as the study of genetic material from environmental samples. So we were at the point where microbiology techniques weren't working. So back to when we were in college, you know, we remember doing just the petri dishes and, you know, figuring out what grew in it. But now we're at a point where we need to learn more about the function of these microbial communities. So samples of the communities are collected with a swab, a stool, or water sample. They're able to reveal the microbial diversity, but more importantly, it allows for DNA sequencing of all this genetic information. So we're able to utilize it for, like I said, for the drug efficacy and, you know, a whole bunch of different things that are going to affect our long-term health. And we get to figure out, too, which ones may help us stay healthy or which ones also can turn on a disease process. So I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with TED Talks, and besides the books that I've put in here, I also wanted to give you some other references that are pretty quick and can help, you know, enhance your knowledge of the microbiome. TED Talks are short, but they're very informative presentations by experts in all kinds of fields. This one specifically was given by Dr. Rob Knight on how microbes make us who we are. It's a very good synopsis. Also, his book was published by TED Talks and is a quick, well-researched read on the microbiome. And he is the one that started the American Gut Project. So I would recommend, we couldn't do videos in this presentation, but there's a minute video on AmericanGut.org that explains it, and it's well worth your time just to know that this option is out there. But it is the world's largest crowd-funded citizen science project in existence. You basically fill out a questionnaire, you send in a stool sample, and it's about $99, and you get the genetic information for your microbiome, and what they get in return is they're able to track trends for geography and diseases. So basically using your questionnaire with the findings from your stool sample, they're able to figure out which basic diseases are pertain to certain geographies. So on the flip side of the nonprofit research company, there are for-profit companies out there that kind of do the same thing as American Gut. It recommends testing your stool if you cannot figure out the sources of certain ailments. So if you look on the right-hand side, they're saying if you know, you can't figure out what's causing abdominal pain, constipation, Crohn's disease, bloating, diarrhea, gas, IBS, those kind of things, then it would make sense to check and see if maybe you have some dysbiosis of a certain strain that can be treated. And then just to, again, keep you in touch with what's going on out there as far as options, you know, the pricing is comparable to the other, but then they also have the, I thought this was interesting, the gut time lapse. So That cost covers sampling your stool three different times. So if you're doing it before, during, and after a diet lifestyle change. So, you know, this is kind of where all this stuff is going, and I think it's pretty exciting. Coursera is an online learning platform, and GutCheck is very educational on the microbiome. It is taught in sections and does have some coursework to it. So it does take a lot of time, but you do learn a lot from it. It is free. They do have a cost if you would like to be certified. So you do have those options with that. So gut check, exploring your microbiome. So other current areas that are being studied with probiotics in the microbiome are Crohn's disease, necrotizing enterocolitis, and those are specifically being studied at WashU here in St. Louis, STDs, acne. I've met a doctor that actually adds probiotics to distilled water and has someone with acne sprayed on their face. So he reports that it helps with inflammation and takes the redness out. So that's kind of exciting and much safer than some of the medications out there. PTSD, diabetes, and obesity is obviously probably the number one to attack as far as figuring out safer ways to treat obesity. Multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, and rheumatoid arthritis are on the top of the list for studies. Another book, Brain Maker, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Dr. Perlmutter. He's a neurologist. He wrote Grain Brain, so Brain Maker was a follow-up to that, and it has a lot of case studies. For example, he had a multiple sclerosis patient that was bedbound, and he started doing probiotic enemas, and the patient completely rebounded. So it's very exciting. And then another good book, too, is Eat Dirt by Dr. Josh Axe. So this is just more of an integrative approach to gut health. And then I'm sure we've all heard of the new frontier of FMT, which stands for fecal microbiota transplantation. Fecal matter is collected from a tested donor, mixed with a solution, strained, and placed in a patient. So it depends on doctors and state regulations, but I know here in Missouri they do some of them NG, through an NG tube. So doctors have explained to me that the higher up that they apply the stool, that the more effective it is. And then they can also do them through fecal enemas, or they can give them the FMT during a colonoscopy. And currently the treatment for C. diff, it's over 90% effective. And there's, not a lot of side effects, so it seems very promising. And the reason why it works so well is it's not that you're just taking one probiotic and hoping that helps, but you're actually transplanting a whole community of someone else's microbiome and not just introducing or adding a few new neighbors, in the analogy of just one or two strains given as a probiotic supplement. I'm sorry, I meant to mention up at the top, too, there are places that are doing FMTs by oral capsules as well. So that would be much more tolerable by patients, I assume. And finally, this transplanted community is able to crowd out that C. diff population. So Open Biome is, as it explains here, a nonprofit stool bank. So if you are familiar with like breast milk banks, it would be something comparable to that. Its purpose is to expand safe access to fecal transplant and catalyzing research into the human microbiome. So if someone didn't have an appropriate donor, they could actually get some from the biome. It's like a bank. So supplementation options and recommendations. How do we as RDs use this information clinically? So I thought we'd do our own little case study here. A 70-year-old patient with watery diarrhea and severe abdominal pain from AAD, antibiotic-associated diarrhea. Her HCP recommends just go buy a probiotic. It doesn't matter which one. So she stops by the store to pick up a probiotic. And this is what she sees. So she is now standing in pain, hoping she does not have an accident in the probiotic section. And she's wondering, which strain? How many CFUs? Which ones work in AAD? Should I get a refrigerated one? Is a supplement okay? Should I just buy the cheapest one? What is a medical food? Do I need more than one strain? So as healthcare professionals, when we just say go buy a probiotic, I think we're doing a disservice to our patients because we need to be specific. And that comes into play with, we're kind of overwhelmed by the amount of data that's out there. For example, we need help as clinicians just with reviewing over those 1,600 studies that came out last year. And references such as the Yale and Harvard Symposium on Probiotics does just that. In the history of the symposium, there was a problem that there was a growing literature on clinical trials, but no increase in clinical recommendations. The first Yale symposium held in 2004 published recommendations in 2005. They meet every 3 to 5 years, and in the 2015 workshop held in March of last year was published in December of last year. And I'll show you how the study reads, but the rankings in the study are A, strong positive studies in the literature, B, positive controlled studies, but some negative studies that do not support primary outcome, and C, some positive studies, but not enough data for certainty. So it's not like A is best, C is worst, it's just a grade of how much literature is out there. So this is what the symposium looks like as far as on the recommendations for probiotic use. They list the clinical condition on the left. They give it a rating of effectiveness. They recommend a specific strain of organism and strain reference. And then they also give you the references of the studies that they evaluated this time around. So going back to our elderly lady, we can picture this. A dad and his infant daughter see you at the pediatric office for infectious diarrhea. He has heard probiotics can help. What probiotics would you recommend? So if you go back to this paper, the Yale and Harvard Symposium, you can see on the top one where it says diarrhea, infectious childhood, effectiveness rating is an A for LGG, Saccharomyces boulardii, and Lactobacillus reuteri. So, you know, as a health practitioner, you would, you know, be helping your patients more if you recommended one of these three strains for that specific condition. So probiotic recommendations as dietitians, you know, we need to make time to check out the research. The cheapest one can be the most expensive because it may not help. You have trillions of bacteria, thousands of strains. It's, you know, imperative that we're looking at the strains and verifying the potency of the product. Give it time. Sometimes, and it depends on how much dysbiosis the patient has going on, but it can take up to a month for that probiotic to colonize and start working. In our references, I have this Harvard webinar that it's about an hour long. It's very good, but they wanted to look at what point does a probiotic become active, and then after someone stops taking a probiotic, how many days after that does the colonization disappear? So in this study, they were, I think they were evaluating LGG, but it looked like when you stopped using it, you know, at day 56, it had disappeared. And finally, if a patient reports probiotics didn't work for them, maybe they didn't try the right one for their clinical condition. So, you know, don't give up on probiotics. If they said they've tried it and it didn't work, you know, that, like I said, they might just need a different one. And this is a topic that I am asked about often, probiotics in Crohn's disease. It makes sense that probiotics would help, but there's a couple issues with it. The most prominent issue is the location of the disease determines efficacy. So we know with ulcerative colitis, it's in the large intestine. That's where probiotics work. Obviously, you can see a lot of benefits with that disease state. However, with Crohn's disease, it depends where it is. So if it's proximally in the small intestine, that makes it more challenging because the higher up it is, the more acidic the gut is and the more oxygenated it is. So we want less oxygen, less acid for a probiotic to thrive. And then if by chance it is distally in the ileum or in the large intestine, the Crohn's disease, it has the most potential to work. So, and just so you know, Crohn's disease patients report that they have an improvement in the gas and bloating, which can be very painful, but the probiotics are not as helpful in disease progression. So they might feel better with the gas being less, but as far as like fistulas and fissures, that will still be an issue of just the disease progressing. And again, you can refer to the symposium if you wanted to read studies on that. And the most tolerant genera of the probiotics that will help with the with Crohn's disease obviously would be more tolerable to oxygen and lower pHs. But Lactobacillus, Streptococcus, and Villanella is are the strains, and there's a reference too that you can read more about that. So RDs and data, you know, we separate ourselves from a lot of people that practice nutrition because we do practice evidence-based medicine. I think it's important to all of us. I know I try to stay up on research, but, you know, just the topics that I've covered here, it's almost overwhelming. So you kind of have to tailor the alerts to your interest or specialty. So for an example, I receive emailed alerts from Microbiome Journal, New Scientist, and then hopefully all of us get the daily news from the Academy's Knowledge Center, and there's a lot of good research findings in that. And then I also follow, you know, via blogs or emails, Dr. Perlmutter, Chris Kresser, Dr. Axe, Dr. Hyman, and Dr. Mercola. But then when we talk about research, there's just a couple things that I wanted to point out, because, you know, I'm guilty of this too. If you get a new study, you know, it's 20 pages long, you typically will read the abstract and the results or conclusion and move on. So with probiotics, it's really important, instead of just the abstract and the conclusion, you know, we need to look who paid for it. And that's really, you know, you should do that with whatever you're looking into, not just probiotics. But, and it's not always painfully obvious who's paying for it. So you may have to even do additional research to uncover if there's a conflict of interest in the studies. And finally, the methods. When it comes to probiotics, which are live microorganisms, how the handling occurs is of the utmost importance. So make sure in the methods that, you know, they're revealing how the product was handled, if it was refrigerated, at what degrees, and then if the product has been mishandled as far as, like, freezing and thawing, because that will definitely affect the viability of the microorganism. So other reputable, unbiased resources that we can use are consumerlab.com and Probiotic Advisor. They both have a cost to join, but Probiotic Advisor is a great reference tool. It's kind of like an automated version of that Yale and Harvard symposium. So you can type in a clinical condition or even a symptom, and it will come back with the strains that have studies and give you some insight as far as what research has been done using that specific strain in the clinical condition you're looking into. So what if you do not have any diagnosis to contend with and you want to add probiotics to your daily routine? So to support your microbiome, add foods that are naturally fermented, like yogurt. Look for active and live cultures and try to find ones that have more than one strain. The common strains are Lactobacillus bulgaricus, Streptococcus thermophilus, Lactobacillus acidophilus. Brands may contain more than seven strains. And this is a good reference, culturesforhealth.com. Sorry, talking so much. I took a drink. Culturesforhealth.com, they have cultures and grains and resources. Excuse me. I'm so sorry. So Cultures for Health. So you can actually make your own Greek yogurt maker. Oh my gosh, I sound terrible. I'm so sorry. And you can get like books or ebooks on the art of fermentation. Kefir and kvass are also great drinks. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Kefir is a tangy dairy drink that's packed with 10 to 20 strains per serving. And kvass is typically made from stale bread, and it has a higher vitamin B content. And then some cheeses are also good for digestion, along with buttermilk or acidophilus milk. And then additional options are sour pickles, tempeh, kombucha, sauerkraut and kimchi, miso, and sourdough bread. And then along with probiotics, we also want to be consuming prebiotics, which are basically non-digestible food ingredients that promote the growth of beneficial microorganisms in the intestine. So basically, you're adding fertilizer to your microbiome. There's a lot of natural prebiotic sources, which I list here, including, you know, foods, raw mostly, but unrefined wheat and barley, raw oats, and then inulin sources, which are added to a lot of high-fiber foods nowadays. And then as another resource, the good gut, taking control of your weight, your mood, and your long-term health. And they talk about the Big Mac diet, obviously not the one at McDonald's. But just looking at each meal that you consume and evaluating for Big Macs, which are microbiota-accessible carbohydrates. So looking at foods that are high in fiber, that will help keep your microbiome healthy. And they have additional recommendations, you know, to start slowly to decrease risk of bloating. Assess every meal for max. And so, in conclusion, instead of thinking of your life in this way, antibacterial soaps killing 99% of bacteria, Clorox playing inside, eating processed foods, a better defense would be kefir over berries for breakfast, yogurt at lunch with raw vegetables, washing your hands appropriately, and getting lots of outdoor activity. Because it's these things that, you know, you're promoting a better defense for our long-term health, and you're not, like I mentioned before, eradicating every bacteria in your life, and therefore you will have a more healthy long-term outlook. So in here I have all of my resources, so you can see there's quite a bit. And again, if you have any questions that we don't cover in the Q&A, if I don't keep choking, I'm so sorry. You can also email me or call me with additional questions following the conclusion of this presentation. So thank you all for attending today.
Okay, Jamie, we do have a few questions in our question box. So the first one is, what is the interaction between probiotics and antibiotics?
So with probiotics, and I am so sorry about that choking spell, but with probiotics and antibiotics, obviously the antibiotics are going to kill off the probiotics. The probiotics will not affect how well the antibiotic works. So it's very important that you're taking a probiotic when you're on an antibiotic. You just want to make sure you take the probiotic either 2 hours before or 2 hours after the antibiotic. And, you know, most people think, I only take that probiotic until I finish my antibiotics, but really I would recommend supplementing for well over a year because the amount of damage that's done with one course of the antibiotics.
Okay, the next question is, if the probiotic colonization disappears after 56 days, how long do you recommend that patients take probiotics to continue to get the benefit of positive bacteria?
Well, if someone has a chronic condition that requires supplements other than, you know, just eating fermented foods, I would say as long as they're having any symptoms. I mean, if they're on the probiotic and they're feeling well and symptom-free and they want a chance, you know, coming off of that probiotic, that's up to them. But, you know, if their symptoms come back, then obviously I would restart the probiotic. So it's kind of hard to say exactly when you should stop and start, not knowing what the patient is dealing with, what their diet is like, but I would say it's almost like a multivitamin too. You know, sometimes you're just trying to stay healthy, and then when you stop supplementing, you know, those previous symptoms might creep back in.
Okay. Another question is, when a patient has been diagnosed with C. diff, is there a recommendation as to how long before a FMT is recommended?
It kind of depends on the doctor. I mean, there's doctors that will do FMT first. That's how well they think of their efficacy. But other than that, most doctors might do a couple rounds of antibiotics. So it really depends on the doctor. But I would say the comfort level with FMTs is growing every day, so I would not be surprised if most doctors go to the FMT first before the antibiotics.
Okay. At what age would you suggest safe for babies to start with probiotics in food like yogurt?
Again, I would probably refer back to your pediatrician and when they're comfortable with introducing dairy foods. So if I would say that most doctors would say at a year, but, you know, there's other ones that say once they're able to sit up and start being spoon-fed, then, you know, it might be closer to 6 to 9 months for yogurt. But I guess I don't understand the question completely if you're concerned with adding probiotics in general or if it's specifically with the food. Can you tell from the question, Monica?
No, I think it's just asking the age of what you would recommend. I mean, yogurt is something that, you know, kids can eat once they start solid, you know, more solid foods. But
right.
And if that person wants to reach out to you with more clarification, they can use your contact information as well.
That sounds good.
Okay, a couple more questions. Is there a probiotic or prebiotic for reducing cholesterol that you're aware of?
Oh, no, I don't. There's none that have that definitive as far as, like, research. I mean, sure, there's some on the market that promote themselves that way, but as far as specific strains, no, there really isn't one that sticks out in my mind.
Okay, what information is available about the benefits for prebiotics from fibers in food? That is, does eating a high-fiber diet contribute enough prebiotic material to benefit gut health?
Yes, but I, you know, as a dietitian, I think, again, variety. So if you're getting all of your fiber intake from a supplement other than from, like, fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains and things like that, I would think that that could affect probably the diversity. So I would recommend high fiber from a diet. As long as you're getting variety, you would be fine with the amount of prebiotics you would consume.
Okay. Another question related to obesity. Have specific strains been identified as helpful in treating obesity?
Not yet. If you go on the Human Microbiome Project website, you can see specifically what strains they're looking at, but a lot of them even just have, they're not like a marketed strain just yet. They might have like a lot of numbers and letters as far as describing the strain. So, again, there's not one right now that's available to go purchase that's specifically for obesity.
Okay, we'll do one more question and then the rest we can follow up with.
Okay.
If with antibiotics, infectious diseases are down and autoimmune diseases are up, is there any study on the use of probiotics in the treatment of autoimmune diseases?
Yes, but it depends on which one. So there's tons of studies with diabetes, and we're looking, you know, like I mentioned, with multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis. So they all, it's not like a blanket recommendation for a probiotic for autoimmune, but it's specific to a disease state. So I know that the Yale and Harvard Symposium, unfortunately, doesn't cover like every single thing out there that we would like to know how probiotics work. But if you look into some of those additional materials, like especially with Dr. Perlmutter, who's a neurologist, he'll look more into like MS, and I think he has some diabetes. So you really, that's why I wanted to give you those additional references so that you can go out and search exactly what ailment or clinical condition you're most involved with.
Okay, well, thank you again, Jamie, for your information. We appreciate it, and I'm going to turn things back over to Rachel.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you again to the St. Louis District Dairy Council for an excellent presentation and our presenter today. We do have quite a few questions, like Monica mentioned, that we did not have a chance to answer live. So I'll get the email out to you by the end of the day on Friday of this week with a link to the recording, the slide handout, as well as your CEU certificate. It'll probably be next week before we'll follow up with a document that covers the Q&A that we were not able to do live. And just a reminder, when I close out the session here in a minute, there'll be a survey, and we appreciate your feedback on that. And just to let you know, SNEB has one more webinar for 2016. The webinar this Friday is a skills building webinar on selecting the right image for your presentation. So if you go to the SNEB website, you'll be able to register for Friday's webinar. Otherwise, we'll see you back in 2017. The Journal Club sessions have already been determined. We'll start on February 6th, looking at policy, systems, and environmental change initiatives and programs to improve health. So thank you very much for your attendance today.